We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In spite of progress made since the 1960s, America remains a country that is divided along racial and ethnic lines. At the same time, scholars who study ethnicity and race say that it would be a mistake to believe that these divisions will remain forever. At least there are good reasons to think that in the near future, this will begin to change. This morning in this hour of focus, we'll be talking with sociologist Richard Alba from the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And he is author of a book that we will talk about. The title is Blurring the Color Line, the subtitle, The New Chance for a More Integrated America. It's published by the Harvard University Press. And in this book, he makes the argument that inequality could narrow dramatically in the coming decades, and demographics will play a big role. Baby boomers will be retiring, and that, he argues, could well open up opportunities for non-whites to advance. We'll explore the argument this morning in this hour of the show and, of course, encourage questions. Just asking people to be brief so we can get as many callers in as possible. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. At any point, questions certainly are welcome. And Professor Alba, hello.
Hi, David. Thank you very much for having me on your show. I'm delighted to have a chance to talk about my book.
Well, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. And I also do want to mention that if people are interested, that this book grew out of a series of lectures that you gave at Harvard, and people actually can view them online. And I think that they're quite interesting, and lots of information there to see.
I haven't dared to look at myself online.
Oh, I thought that they were wonderful. I don't think that you should hesitate. But I know what you mean. Well, I guess that perhaps the place to start here is to acknowledge that it is certainly true that ethnicity and race have a lot to do with the kind of lives that people can live in America today, and what people can do with their life, and what kind of education they're going to get, and what kind of job they can have, and where they can live, and that all of these things are particularly acute and have been for some time now for African Americans.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. First of all, as you say, that what kind of family you're born into, not just, you know, what level of education your parents have, how much wealth they have, but what the color of their skin is and what their cultural background has a tremendous impact on the possibilities within your own life. And as I think you said at the beginning of the show, the inequalities among groups have stalled, really, since the early 1970s. Just one indicator is that the relationship between the average black family income and the average white family income has really not changed at all. After improving somewhat starting in the 1960s, it just stopped improving in the 70s and has remained fairly constant and unequal since that time. And in some ways, one could even argue that matters are growing worse for minority groups in America. That's particularly true because of the high levels of incarceration, imprisonment that the United States has seen since 1980. We lead the world, in fact, at least the democratic world, in terms of the rate at which we put our citizens behind bars. But overwhelmingly, the people we're putting behind bars are young people of color, particularly young men of color, not white Americans. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think the book says that there's a new opportunity, a period of new opportunity ahead, but that we as a nation have to do some things in order to make the best use of that opportunity.
Well, I want to go back a little bit into American history, and in the process of asking and trying to provide some answer to this question, can we expect, might we expect this to change?
Mm-hmm.
You say, well, you know, you actually can learn some interesting things if you go back and you look at the experiences of people that have generally been referred to as white ethnics. So we're talking about people who came from Ireland, from southern Eastern Europe, people who primarily were Roman Catholic. Also, some of these people were Jews, people who came to the United States. And when they came, and for the first decades at least that they were here, experienced very significant discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, they became assimilated and entered into the mainstream. First, though, maybe again, remind us of some of this history that we have forgotten.
Well, thank you for asking me that question and putting it in the way that you did. And I think I want to underscore something you said, which is absolutely right. We can learn some things. And it would be a mistake to think that the near future in America could replicate what happened during what I call the period of mass assimilation of the white ethnics, which is roughly the 25 years following World War II. But, you know, if we look back at that history, we can see that distinctions that seem to matter very much to powerful Americans can fade. And they can fade in a very short period of time. So on the eve of the war, I think it would be fair to say that these groups were really on the margins of the American mainstream. By no means was their situation as bad as that of African Americans, but they seemed to have reached a point where they might, in fact, be sort of permanently a kind of middle stratum of American society, lodged in between non-whites at the bottom and whites of Protestant affiliations at the top. What made it possible, I think, for these divisions to change was a period of what I call non-zero-sum mobility. So basically the prosperity of America in the 25 years following World War II made it possible for the country to kind of open up its system in a variety of ways to allow these groups to move up without really threatening the kinds of opportunities that white Protestant Americans took for granted. Education is one index of how the system opened up. So In the 25 years following World War II, literally the number of students going to college quintupled. That is, it went up by a factor of five. And this was really a result of very large-scale public investment in state colleges and universities, which just tremendously expanded their intake of students. My own state is an example. The State University of New York was founded in 1948, just after the war, and at the moment of its founding, it was a motley collection of colleges and colleges really that enrolled about 30,000 students. By 1970, it was a massive system, 64 colleges and universities, and enrolled 300,000 students. So clearly, in that expansion, there was then the opportunity for a lot more young people who, had they been born in earlier decades, would not have had the chance to go to college, to in fact have the chance to do so. And so we see then a period of catch-up. So groups that had lagged behind in educational attainment, like the Southern Italians, caught up by 1970. Now, non-zero-sum mobility wasn't the only thing going on in this period. And I think there is sort of a theory that we can take out of this period that has some application to the near future. Probably the other most important factor was social integration. And so in the aftermath of the war, this social integration was reflected above all in the changing residential locations of white Americans, and specifically in the massive suburbanization of people who had lived in cities, many of them people coming out of these ethnic communities. And the suburbs, which were often racially segregated, that is to say, pretty much barring the entry of non-whites, nonetheless mixed together whites of a variety of ethnic and religious backgrounds, people who are at the same stage of their life cycles, often who mix together in PTAs and, you know, as the coaches of sports teams, and whose children befriended one another and then intermarried. So this was, it's these two things, the ability of groups to move up in status and their ability then to integrate with the mainstream population that I think primarily account for the great decline in the significance of what had been quite significant ethnic and religious boundaries among whites.
Mm-hmm. Something else that you talk about that is not something that's likely to be replicated, but it was important here, was the Second World War and the way that that experience brought people together, and the way that for the kind of people that we're talking about, the fact that they, like everybody else who was able, pitched in, and a lot of people went off to fight the war, that is that enhanced their identity as Americans, so these other or more traditional, older, white Protestant Americans now could look at Irish people and Italian people and Polish people and say, well, you know, you went off, you did your bit, you sacrificed like everybody else, so I guess that means that you're one of us.
No, I think that's absolutely right, and the book does say that, of course. And yeah, I think that the period of World War II led to a kind of new narrative about who was American and or who was authentically American. And for the first time, these groups, which had really been in many ways disparaged by Protestant Americans in previous decades, came to be included in the kind of magic circle then of the authentically American. And it was really, I think, a self-conscious effort on the part of media elites, political elites, to, if you will, drum up a kind of national unity among the groups that were contributing the most men to the fighting forces. So the journalism of World War II, for the first time, kind of acknowledges the ethnic diversity of American fighting forces. And even more than the novels, the films, I mean, many of these are, you know, extremely famous. The Naked and the Dead, From Here to Eternity, etc. All of them also, you know, put a spotlight on ethnic diversity and portrayed ethnic Americans as not necessarily in authority. I mean, authority was often still in the hands of white Protestant Americans in these films, but nevertheless, people who were contributing sometimes heroically to the war effort, therefore people who were the moral equals of other white Americans.
Mm-hmm. So just to go back to underscore one point, and it's useful in thinking about not only where we've been but where we're heading, that is, you make this argument that truly the gap between the people that we're talking about and the old white American Protestant mainstream really didn't close up until after 1950, and that one of the things that was happening at the time was the boom in the American economy really made it possible, again, going back to the phrase you use, to get away from zero-sum mobility, that is to say that it was possible that for when these people moved up, it was not at the expense of someone else. That is, their moving up did not require somebody else to move down.
Exactly. And so when we have a more zero-sum situation, then groups that are more powerful, more privileged, have strong motivations to protect their position. And we can see examples of that in the pre-World War II setting. So, for example, when Jews began to show up in large numbers at the gates of Ivy League institutions and with very strong school records, those institutions instituted quotas to limit, in some cases drastically limit, the number of Jews who could be admitted. Or another example, which is not in the book, and I actually regret that I didn't include it, is when Al Smith, the first, you know, Catholic ever to be nominated by a major political party for the presidency, ran in 1928. There was a mass mobilization of white Protestants, including, you know, many ministers speaking from their pulpits against Smith as a candidate, to prevent this guy from becoming president. I mean, the statement was, "This is our country. You know, you are not going to be able to assume leadership of our country." And, of course, we can then contrast this with what happened after the war, in an election that was still very contested along religious lines, namely the election of Kennedy, and also, to be sure, I mean, the election of Barack Obama as president in 2008, again, an election that was in part contested along racial lines, is nevertheless, you know, a very dramatic step forward.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Richard Alba. He is Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and we are talking about some of the ideas you'll find in his book, Blurring the Color Line, A New Chance for a More Integrated America. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Harvard University Press.
Maybe I could say something, Dave,
yes,
if you don't mind,
yes,
to kind of update the story to
mm-hmm.
today
mm-hmm.
and say a little bit about why I think there's a special opportunity ahead, but one that we just can't take for granted, that we're going to have to take some steps as a nation in order to make the best use of it. And that opportunity revolves around this concept of non-zero-sum mobility, moments when groups can move up, you know, and as you nicely put it, without somehow taking something away from somebody else. And in the near future, that opportunity is going to come about, as you said at the beginning of the show, because of the retirement of the baby boom. So the baby boom is the very large group of Americans born between 1946 and 1964. It's the post-World War II birth cohorts. It is a largely white group. It is a very highly educated group. In fact, it's probably the most highly educated group in American history. That's partly because of the incentives for young men to stay in college during the Vietnam War. And if you look at where it is in the labor market, it is just extremely well-placed. You know, it accounts for high proportions of a lot of the best-paying jobs. I think it's 70% of the lawyers, 70% of the registered nurses, and so forth. Over the next 25 years, between now and the early 2030s, when the youngest baby boomer will turn 70, these folks are going to leave the labor market. And the realities of demography are such that there are not enough whites in young cohorts who are to replace them. So therefore, some other Americans are going to have the opportunity to take some of the places that are currently held by white baby boom Americans. And so that's the chance of non-zero-sum mobility. And this could mean then that African Americans, Hispanic Americans are going to move up in much larger numbers than we have seen recently. Nevertheless, there's a problem, and the problem has to do with the large educational gaps, especially in post high school education, that separate white Americans from non-white Americans, particularly from black and Hispanic Americans. So if we look at the most recent levels of educational attainment, in other words, those attained by young people who are now leaving the educational system and going into the job market, we find that in terms of college graduation and post-college credentials, that whites lead non-whites by a 2-to-1 margin. And, you know, I think we can see these inequalities, which are very large, as a function of the way the American school system currently works and the way in which it delivers a different quality of education to people from different backgrounds. I mean, there's a raft of evidence to show that there are large gaps in terms of school-related skills between the average white American student and the average black or Hispanic student, and that these gaps really don't change very much. They don't get better as young people stay in school. So I think this is something we need to attend to. And we need to attend to it not just to create opportunity for non-white Americans. We need to attend to it in order to preserve America's place in the world economy. Mm. As the baby boom retires, the American economy is going to be losing a lot of its most highly trained, most highly qualified workers. And the challenge, if we're going to maintain our position in the world, is going to be to replace these people. And I argue that there's no sensible strategy for meeting this need that doesn't make better use than the country is making of minority youth. In other words, we really have to turn our attention to giving black and Hispanic kids better educations than they're currently receiving.
All right. We have a caller, and I'd like to invite others, if you have questions for the guest, 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are. We also do have that toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. First caller here up is in Cisna Park on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Yeah, David, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Very interesting show. Looks like I fit into your demographic on a number of levels, being a white male, 54 years old.
Mm-hmm. You're a baby boomer.
tail end of the baby boomers. Very interesting topic. Maybe I could share a couple of experiences with your guest, and feel free, he can go ahead and comment on them. Mm-hmm. Cutting into the problem, I think we're all aware of the problem. Now, what's the solution? I was wondering if your guest could speak. There seems to be a 10,000-pound elephant in the room, and everyone is very, very careful and politically correct these days. But with the black population, the African-American population, something like 80% of the kids are born either to single mothers or kids out of wedlock, mm-hmm. so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And if you follow those statistics, those kids have, basically 2.5 strikes against them before they even get into the batter's box as far as their success in life. And I'm just wondering, the programs and all of that, is they're excellent, and nobody wants to see them succeed more than I do. But I don't know how you can put the toothpaste back in the tube unless we correct that one core issue. Yes, there is a racial problem in this country, but I'm just wondering how much of it is driven by economics. In other words, if you can't get in there and be one of the players, then, yeah, you are going to have all these negative things happen to you, including incarceration and all these other things. And so I'm just wondering if we could cut to the core as far as the family matters, family virtues, if that's a significant part. And yeah. I'll go ahead and listen off there. Thanks.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, I agree that it is an issue that so many young kids, and not just black kids, by the way, but white kids too, grow up in single-parent families. And, of course, it's probably a worse situation for the black kids because they're often not only in single-parent families but in very poor single-parent families. This is a relatively new phenomenon. If you go back 50 years, the levels of single parenthood in the African-American population were very different. It's also, of course, a rising phenomenon among whites. So, we can see that there are some general trends at work here that have a particular impact on the African-American community. You said economics in there, and I think that if the implication was that the level of single parenthood among African Americans reflects in part economics conditions that blacks face, I agree with that. That is to say that single parenthood becomes more likely because it's difficult for families, especially for black men, to earn enough income to keep their families together. And so I think that it's possible that this would improve as economic opportunity improves. But I also think that we recognize that this is a big problem. And it's a big problem because it has huge social costs, not just in terms of young people who, have truncated educations, but also in terms of young people who wind up involved in criminal careers, wind up in prison. Think again of the huge prison population that taxpayers have to support. So it would seem to me that this is where public policy could make a difference by helping these families in a very direct ways to raise their children, for example, by preschool programs, which are we don't have enough of in this country. Many countries in Europe have universal preschool for children, so it's not just, their socialization is not just dependent on their parents. It's also dependent then on the school settings, on the peers, that they encounter in them. France, for example, has a universal preschool program that children attend starting from the age of 3. So I think there are ways we can address this, but I do agree it's a problem. But it is a problem that we ought to say, we can't do anything about it. It's a problem that we ought to say there are things we can do about it.
All right, let's talk with another caller here in Urbana, where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. I noticed you mentioned early in your remarks that the wages for Black Americans have been standing still since the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like you to comment if you can, or note if you can. That phenomenon has been happening basically anyone in a blue-collar profession.
Mm-hmm.
Of any sort, that's been happening to them too. And, of course, the effects of globalization and the fact that the manufacturing jobs that used to exist here now exist someplace else have played into that played to that problem also and caused that problem. So I guess what I'm saying is that, you know, the phenomenon of the black wages standing still is not limited to them. I think it's that you could see a across the board the any kind of cohort you want to call blue collar, they've experienced the same situation as well. And I would suggest, and I see what you think, is if we in this country could have a resurgence of organized labor.
I agree with you.
And a return to and call it protectionism if you want. I'm of the opinion that if you want to sell it here, you build it here. And if you've got a better way of building it here, that's your advantage. But otherwise, you make television sets and you want to sell them in the United States, you better make them in the United States. And comment as you would, please. Thank you.
Well, I certainly agree that the growing inequality of American society. I mean, we're often characterized today as having a Gilded Age level of economic inequality, inequality in earnings, inequality in incomes, inequality in wealth. These are really at staggering levels. And this is, by the way, then a very different situation from that during the post-World War II incorporation of the white ethnics, because this is a period called the Great Compression by economic historians because of its very low level of economic inequality. And if we're going to address the situation of the heavy minority concentration among the ranks of the poor, we do have to do something about economic inequality. And we certainly should want to do something about economic inequality to help ordinary lower middle class, working class families, whatever their race. Whether the labor movement can come back, I don't know. And it's true that the trends in globalization seem to be working against the supply of really good blue-collar jobs in the U.S. And I do think, as you, I guess, do, that this is something that could turn around. And particularly, I think it might turn around because of the growing costs of transportation across long distances. So, I think we might be entering a period when there is going to be a great deal of concern about the carbon output of human activities and the costs of transportation of, let's say, cars across long distances might become more important factor that companies consider. And that might lead to more location of plants in the United States. That we maybe will make more things in this country in the foreseeable future. At least that's my hope. I can't say it's my expectation.
We are a bit past our midpoint in this hour of Focus 580. Let me again introduce our guest, Richard Alba. He's Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. We're talking about some of the ideas that you will find in his book, Blurring the Color Line, The New Chance for a More Integrated America. It's published by the Harvard University Press, in which he makes the argument that we are coming to a time when there could be real opportunity for economic advancement for non-white Americans. Americans, and that demographics, sort of simple demographics, makes that possible as the baby boomers begin to retire. And the labor force is going to need a lot of people at all levels, but certainly at the upper levels of the income scale. And there's a good opportunity, he says, there for people to, non-whites, to move into those positions. He says this is not a guaranteed scenario. There are other possibilities, but this is one that is certainly very possible, given that we pay attention to certain kinds of things. And one of them he's certainly talked about, and that is education. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let me just ask you about another point that you make, and this comes under this heading of other possible futures, other possible scenarios, that it is possible that some other things happen, and that is, for example, white women advance in, and certainly I think that there's this broad feeling that there are a lot of women who perhaps are underemployed or that their possibilities aren't what they should be. There also, I guess, is the possibility that newcomers, immigrants, will come in to take some of those jobs, and that then Americans, non-white Americans, are going to be competing with there's this possibility that they will be competing with some of these other demographic groups.
Absolutely. And I view it as a certainty that women will advance in the future, that we're going to need to make better use of their talents than we have in the past. They are now, of course, young women are more highly educated than their brothers. And that is going to change very much the dynamic. If you look, though, where women are the most underrepresented and therefore where there's the greatest possibility for their advance, it's really at the very, very top of the labor market in the most elite jobs. I call that sector the top decile, the top 10% of jobs in the book. And, you know, I think that we're certainly going to see gains for women in the top decile. But I think unless something fundamental changes about our family arrangements, I think we're still going to see many educated women with careers that, at least during the family stage, are kind of intermittent, if you will. You know, in other words, they work full-time for some periods, and then they work at lesser intensity or maybe withdraw from the labor market while they devote themselves to raising their children. And I think that will limit the ability of women, especially white women, to take over or to replace the baby boom. It's in some also very desirable sectors of the labor market, but ones that are below the top decile. So, you know, as I read the evidence about women and their underrepresentation, I think there's still going to be a lot of room for minorities to move up. Now, immigrants, that's a really interesting question. And, you know, I think that we can already see that in Washington, people are concerned about how they're going to meet the needs of creating a highly trained workforce in the coming years as the baby boom retires. And I'm sure that there are policymakers in Washington who think that new immigrants are going to be a key to replacing the baby boomers. Immigrants already play a very significant role in the more highly educated strata of the labor markets. We can see that, for example, with the very sharp rise of Asian immigrants in professional and technical positions. The question is, can we really increase our intake of highly educated immigrants? And I'm skeptical, and I'm skeptical for the following reason. I think that we haven't yet faced the fact that we're going to have to compete with a number of other rich countries for these highly desired streams of immigrants. In a number of respects, the situation in Europe is even more dire than that in the United States, because there's been low fertility in a number of European countries over several decades. So I think that unless there were a real increase in the supply of such immigrants, that it's going to be worldwide. The competition we're going to face for from other countries like Germany or Scandinavia is going to mean that we're probably not going to be able to increase our streams of highly trained immigrants much more, much above what they are today. So, and even if we could, immigrants tend to go into certain kinds of jobs where, say, communication skills are not at a premium because they are not fully acculturated members of the society. They don't have the language abilities, the communication skills that native-born Americans have. So I argue we still need to worry about recruiting people from underutilized populations in the U.S., and those are minority populations.
Okay, let's go to Champaign for our next caller. Line one. Hello.
Yes, it's very interesting, your work. I unfortunately haven't had a chance to read your book, but I...
Well, please do.
Okay, thank you. One problem I have is the demographics as opposed to the problem of education that you referred to, which I want to take note again, something you and the other caller, a previous caller, mentioned, was the problem of economics. And we're, of course, a state university here. Number of internationals of any state university in the nation. And we're increasingly dependent on revenue from internationals.
Mm-hmm.
We also are having a budget meltdown, as it were, in the state right now.
Mm-hmm.
And this is not unique to us, of course, throughout the country. State universities are in a terrible fiscal crisis. My sense is, looking on campus in the classroom and as an administrator, that we're not increasing at all the number of African Americans,
mm-hmm.
And not very many Hispanics either. Mm-hmm. And it's related, I think, directly to the fact that we are having to increase tuition.
Mm-hmm.
We're at, I think, $12,600 roughly, which is extremely high nationally.
Mm-hmm.
So the many African Americans and capable African Americans in the state, whatever their initial primary education is, really don't have the financial means to get here, barring major programs, of course, affirmative action and so forth we have. But the university does not have the wherewithal right now to improve that. And in fact, unfortunately, the university has gone the sort of corporate university route, as we say, and is increasingly trying to govern by what increasing private support.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the people of the state will simply not, at least via the legislature, do anything about the situation. So I can't imagine, at least in the state of Illinois, that the condition, despite the demographics right now, unless one does something about the economics, the fundamental economics of state universities and the educational system mm-hmm. more generally, I can't see that, that things will get much better for the next 10 years or so.
Yeah, but, of course, remember, I'm talking about a 25-year process.
Uh-huh.
And so a lot of things could change in that period. And I have to say, I do think that what happens with education depends on the political leadership of this country. You know, I think we face, and I want to emphasize it again, it's not just a question of providing new opportunities to minorities. It's a challenge of maintaining our economic position in a global economy. And meeting that challenge is going to require that we recruit more very highly educated people, not only to just replace the baby boomers who are retiring, but in some senses to fill new positions that are likely to open up as the economy returns to a period of expansion. Now, I used to teach at the State University of New York. I now teach at the City University of New York. You know, I'm unfortunately well aware of the economic problems that state universities face. I think that, though, that a lot of the educational issues concern not the university level but lower levels, because we know, you know, that by the time young people finish high school, there are very large skill differences on average between minority Americans and white Americans. And I argue that over the last 40 or 50 years, we've tolerated a kind of growing inequality in the kind of education that's delivered to groups of people. And one index of that is a very well-known phenomenon. It's called the declining quality of teaching. You know, and in the 50s, when, let's say, there were fewer opportunities for women to be in occupations other than teaching. Very high numbers of what were then a very select group of female college students went into teaching as a profession. And we know that, I mean, the data are very clear that over time, the academic skills of the young people who are entering the teaching profession have weakened. And I think we can do something about that. We can make teaching more attractive as a profession. That does mean investment. It means, you know, investment in a way that is going to improve the salaries and the working conditions of teachers. And I think that that's one thing that's granted, it's expensive. There's no question about that. But what's the alternative? How are we going to stay, you know, at our position of great economic power unless we're willing to make these investments? So, you know, again, I argue it's really a matter of political leadership and not necessarily, you know, Barack Obama making the right speech today. I mean, we're talking about a 25-year process. Of course, it does have to start at some point in the near future, but it doesn't have to reach very high levels of investment right away. Now, as to the universities, let me say that I think that the demography is such that there will be more minority Americans showing up at the portals of universities, both public and private. There aren't going to be as many young white people in the future as there have been. And so if the universities don't reflect this changing demography, then we're in very big trouble as a society.
I want to thank the caller and jump in here because we just have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus, and I have another caller I'd like to get to, and also would like to once again introduce the guest for anyone who might just have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes. Richard Alba is a distinguished professor of sociology at the Graduate Center, City University of New York. We're talking about some of what you will find in his book, Blurring the Color Line. So if you'd like to delve into that more deeply, you can go out and take a look at the book. It's published by the Harvard University Press. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let's take another call. This is someone in Effingham, line 4. Hello.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, David. I would like to interject an overview here. Mm-hmm. The United States, which is a small percentage of the world population, mm-hmm. and the problems we have here with the upper classes and the small ownership in a meaningful way of resources and money, mm-hmm. Has followed the path of England and Western Europe. Meanwhile, the rest of the world's 6.5 billion people mm-hmm. clamor to live day by day. Mm-hmm. And those problems, which are not addressed and continue not to be addressed, will somehow are haunting us now with these wars that we're engaged in mm-hmm. against minorities in other nations, especially the non-white. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a racist. I don't think that the problems that are based on race, but upon capitalism and how it has winnowed down to a very few people around this earth. And my question to you is, how do you perceive that all that is going to change? It's only gotten worse.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess, you know, I wrote a book addressing racial inequality in American society, and I don't disagree with what you're saying. It's just that it's beyond what I can, you know, pretend I can really address. I would make a couple of points, though. One is that I strongly support an immigration policy that allows large numbers of people coming from poor countries to come to the United States. I'm, you know, against a policy such as the one that was entertained in the 2007 Congress, thank heavens, went down to defeat, that would have changed the system of immigration to recruit highly educated immigrants coming mainly from Asian countries. So it may be a very modest contribution that the U.S. makes by letting in, say, many poor people from Latin America, but it's a non-trivial contribution, given, for example, the remittances that those people send back to the home countries and the opportunities that they and certainly their children have to move up in American society. I do think that we are stuck with capitalism. And I think that the prospects for a fundamental change in the nature of the economic system are so remote that they're not even worth really talking about. So it's a question of how do we make capitalism better so that it functions better for a broad mass of people. And in a sense, that is what the book is about, because I'm concerned with making it better for minority Americans. Granted, you know, that doesn't solve the huge problems that you're alluding to. Maybe I'll do that in the next book.
We have about 5 minutes left. I want to come back and at least give you the opportunity to talk about two things. You talked a little earlier about what happened pretty much here after World War II,
yes,
with the opening up of the economy and the creation of new opportunities for people to move up.
Mm-hmm.
Also at the same time, there was something that was happening demographically in the sense that there was a big movement away from cities into suburbs,
mm-hmm,
which also had an effect on mixing people up more.
Yes.
But this gets to sort of two things. One is that I think that a lot of people would argue that maybe more than anything else, one of the biggest problems that African Americans particularly face is
segregation.
Is residential segregation. It is, in so many ways, where you live determines what
and
kind
I
of life.
I agree with that.
So there is an issue, and then also there is the issue of what you call cultural acceptance, and the likelihood: are we going to move toward a time when at least, because racism still does exist and is still a factor, can we really expect that there might be some lessening of that?
Well, I think that, you know, the book does not say that racism is going to die.
Mm.
But it does argue that under the right circumstances, racism could lessen. And that at least those minorities who are moving up in the labor market, achieving higher occupational status, will experience greater social acceptability to white Americans. And I do think that could happen. In fact, I think inevitably it will happen to some extent. The precise extent really depends upon our ability to make use of this 25-year window for really kind of allowing groups to move up. Let me give you one way in which it's almost certainly going to happen, and that is a growing diversity within white families. And we already see, because of the changing demography, that intermarriage across these very big ethno-racial category lines is increasing, and intermarriage is increasing for whites. Now, it's still at very modest levels for whites, but as the demographic composition of young age groups continues to change, unless whites become much more reluctant to marry across ethno-racial lines, there are going to be more marriages between whites and non-whites. I mean, that follows from a principle that's been very well established in marriage studies, namely that marriage rates between groups depend in part on the pool of eligibles, you know, who's out there to marry. And when the number of white potential partners goes down, then people look to other groups to find a potential partner who's more to their liking in terms of, you know, whether it's various kinds of cultural tastes or lifestyle or whatever. Now, intermarriage has a pronounced effect on family circles, when we begin to take into account not just the person who's married, but that person's parents, you know, their siblings, their aunts, uncles, etc. One demographer, Joshua Goldstein, who used to be at Princeton and now is in at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, did a little interesting exercise, tried to calculate what we could call a multiplier factor. And he found that for whites, every kind of intermarriage had like a 14 times greater impact on the diversity within family circles. And so we're going to see much more diversity within family circles, and that is, I believe, going to erode to some extent racist attitudes and increase the social acceptability of non-whites to whites.
Mm. And I suppose if you then combine that with the kind of projections for possible diversity, increasing diversity in the workplace, and if that can somehow be tied to increasing diversity in housing,
right,
that all of that stuff kind of all mixes together to break, to, in a sense, to blur, to take the
absolutely,
the title, to blur the lines.
To blur the lines. Now, you know, there are going to be whites who are resistant to this. There's no question about that. And we all, I mean, you can sort of see the resistance to President Obama, in part, I won't ascribe it all to this by any means, but in part, it does reflect a racial factor. I was watching, you know, one video on a news program of a congressional representative, a Republican, meeting with some of her constituents, and this was at the time when the birther movement was getting a lot of attention. And this woman, a white woman, came up to the congresswoman and said, "You've got to do something about this. He just can't be our president." And the way she said it, I mean, you knew in your gut that she was saying, we can't have this black guy as our president. And I think on a wider scale, then, that certainly could happen as American society becomes more diverse. But I think the forces that are pushing toward greater diversity are much greater in the long run than those of resistance.
Well, there we'll have to stop. We're here at the end of this hour. Our guest, Richard Alba, is Distinguished Professor of Sociology at the Graduate Center at City University of New York. If you'd like to read more of his ideas on this subject, look for the book Blurring the Color Line. The subtitle is The New Chance for a More Integrated America, published by the Harvard University Press. Professor Alba, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.